Okay, so this is a collaboration with my former postdoc Xiahu Yang and my longtime collaborator Frank Vandenbosch. Okay, so I think for this audience, I don't need to say this relation is very important. In fact, the whole program, to some extent, is try to establish this kind of relationship. But what I will use is a kind of method that's not directly related to gravitational lensing, but toward the end of the talk, I will also make connections there, and I will convince you actually the different methods, they are complementary. So when we talk about structure formation nowadays, then we really mean well-defined cold dark matter paradigm. Well, at least this is a paradigm. And this paradigm is well-defined, described by only a small set of parameters. And in fact, this small set of parameters are also well-constrained nowadays by various observations. And I don't need to go into the detail what observations come into this constraint. And this is the new concordance model. The parameters are listed here. But if we say we believe we are living in such a universe, then when we talk about structure formation, there are generic properties in this process. First of all, is that structure formation is a hierarchical kind of process. In a sense, is that small things form early, and then they merge to, with each other, and then form bigger and bigger systems. And a very, very important concept here is dark matter halos. And dark matter halos, they are, by definition, this is virialized clumps of dark matter particles. What I want to emphasize here is two things. One thing is that if you have a CDM type of model, where your power spectrum is quite steep, and that actually says that almost all mass, all dark matter particles, are in dark matter halos of different kind of masses. So that's a very important thing. And the second thing is that dark matter halos, they are well-defined objects. And in fact, if you use the Weyl theorem or spherical collapse model, you'll find the mean density within the radius, the Weyl radius, is something like 400 times the mean density of the universe. So these things are well-defined. The density contrast actually is quite high. And here, this is the mean density at the time in your question. And more importantly is that we believe galaxies we see today, they are all formed in dark matter halos. This may not be exact, but I think that's a very good assumption at the moment. The good things about CDM halos are that we, it's a very, very simple kind of a process, the formation of the dark matter halos, and that we know a lot of things about this population of objects. The first thing, nowadays we know quite well about a mass function, that is how many, if you are given a CDM model, then you can predict how many halos are there in the universe as a function of mass. So this is the mass function. Not only that, we also know quite well how different kind of halos are distributed in the universe. This is a spatial clustering or halo bias. They're not exactly distributed as the mass, but we understand quite well how they are biased against, with respect to mass. We talk a lot about the internal structures, although there are a lot of uncertainties there concerning density profile, shape, substructure, angular momentum. I would say actually we understand quite a lot of them. We talk about, we can really talk about, a small set of models, like, the density profile, either NFW or more, whatever. And we talk many things about subhalos, and as time goes on, I think we can understand quite well this population of objects as well. But now, if we want to make connections to what we can see, but that's, and actually the situation is not that simple. That's because if you want to know how galaxies are formed in these halos, then you need to understand, the processes evolved in galaxy formation. That's the star formation feedback. Everybody knows about that. Okay, but now if I ask another question, I forget about all these detailed physical processes. And I'm using the fact that now we have a well-defined cosmology, and that observations nowadays can give me a lot of information about the galaxy distribution. How can I make connections of them? And in fact, as I said, since dark matter particles, they are in halos, and the galaxies, they are, at least we believe, they are the residing halos. And in fact, this relation can be described quite easily, or in a sense, by a single function, maybe not well, the basic connection. That is a so-called halo occupation model people are talking about nowadays. So what is going on here? There is, okay, if I know here there are halos, this is density, CDM density spectrum, density field, but they are really just halo density field, right? If I know for a halo of a given mass, I know how many galaxies are there in this halo, then I can just populate these galaxies into this halo, and then I get the distribution of galaxies, of course. Then if your model is correct, then you got to match what you observe here, okay? So then I will see how you have different constraint so that you can constrain this kind of a so-called halo occupation distribution, as it is well constrained by matching these two. Now this tells us how galaxies form. And that's a model independent way in a sense. So this is the first part. And the second part, since now we have wonderful observations from Snow Digital Sky Survey, 2DF, or many of these big surveys, we can also do this, establish this relation in another way. That is, we try to select galaxy systems. As long as we select systems in such a way that these systems represent dark matter halo to some extent, then we can also try to establish the halo-galaxy relationship in this way. And we will see, and these two ways actually, they compare with each other. You can just cross-check. And actually, the fact that these two different approaches give you more or less the same result, that's encouraging, okay?
Could I ask you to tell us more about the parenthetical comment there of given properties?
Of
you write for all given properties.
Parentheses.
This one.
In galaxy.
Oh, yeah. Okay, sorry.
So
galaxies, they are not only points, right? It's only a number, but then you
tend to have different luminosity.
Yeah, different luminosity, different morphology, or different this kind of thing. That's all coming.
How many Draco galaxies are there?
How many
Draco?
Yes, that's right. We'll see how many. Well. Yeah. So thanks for pointing out this. Actually, when we talk about galaxies, if you go into detail, of course, you have different kind of galaxies, and the occupation statistic should be built for different kind of galaxies if you want to go into detail. Okay.
Well, so you're using an average galaxy. You're using.
Well, we do both. Sometimes you do average galaxy, or you for galaxies of different luminosity, so that or galaxies of different color, say. Okay, so before we go into the detail, I think you have seen this kind of pictures before, but there's something very, very, very important point here. Just by looking at these two figures, what plot here, this is the luminosity function of galaxies, and it is obtained from 2DF, okay? And there's the number of galaxies versus luminosity. So this is what you observe. And here, this is what theory gives you. This is a halo mass function, which plots the number of number density of halos versus mass. So what I want to draw your attention to is that the shape of this function, they are very different. First of all, this is the fin end slope is something like -1, this alpha, right? While here, for CDM halos, the generic kind of thing, this is -2. And no matter what you change, sigma 8 or this, this is very, very stable. It's -2. Okay, this is -1, this is -2. So this is one difference. Another thing is that here you have a break. This is at L star, and beyond which you do, the density goes down very rapidly. And this one also has a break. This is M star, something like that. and it breaks as well. But these two breaks occur at a different abundance. This one, the abundance here, is 10 to the minus 2. You know, this is the volume density, right? While here, this is about 2 orders of magnitude lower than that. This is 10 minus 4. So that already tells you L star and M star, they are not the same thing. So if you want to really just convert this one into this one, it is a very, very linear process. So the early notion that we may have, galaxies of trace mass, that's completely wrong. It's really a very nonlinear transformation process. That's what makes this interesting, because that says there must be a lot of physics going on to shape this kind of curve into this. Okay. Yes.
So some of those long mass halos presumably are within larger halos.
Yeah.
And so how does your E of M, how does that avoid that?
Okay.
Counting? So
right. So here, the mass function here does not include sub-halos. This is only the halos. Okay. So that's, Okay, now, there's some mathematics. As I said, this conditional, this is a kind of halo occupation process. Well, actually, I maybe go up a little bit. So I said, you can convert this into this using halo occupation kind of statistics. And here we are talking about the conditional luminosity function. What is the conditional luminosity function? There is, given a halo of mass M, what is the luminosity distribution in these halos? So this answers part of Paul's question. Here we are really talking about, we use luminosity. That's the most important property, I would say. And of course, you can also just label the galaxies by their color and other properties. Now, these are the constraints on this conditional luminosity function. It's very easy, right? And so if you have observed the luminosity function of galaxies, this is what you observe. And if you have a model, CDM model, then you can predict how many halos are there. Then this luminosity function and the mass function, they are just related through this conditional luminosity function, right? So this is one constraint. This side, you have observation. And this side, you have theory. And what is unknown is this function. Then you can also do other things, similar things. Look at the average luminosity in a halo of a given mass, M. And again, it's very easy. This is just the integration of this conditional luminosity function and weighted by L. Again, this side you can observe if you have an independent mass estimate. And this side, again, is dependent only on this this conditional luminosity function. And this is more or less the same thing. If you count galaxies above some luminosity, then again, this is given by the conditional luminosity function. Now, not only that, the clustering properties of galaxies can also be related to that of halos through these simple equations. Well, here we're talking about a large scale, so then you have a linear bias. So then the galaxy-galaxy correlation function for galaxies of some luminosity is a bias factor times that of dark matter. Okay? And this bias factor, now we're talking about galaxies, the bias factor for galaxies of luminosity L actually is related to the mass function of halos, the halo bias, and then again, only through this conditional luminosity function. Again, this side you can observe by observing galaxy correlation functions. And all this side and this one, they are all model predictions. This is the mass two-point correlation function. And the bias factor for halos, as I said, we know quite well. And then the mass function is quite well. Again, here you have a relationship between observables and the other side is a theory, except this conditional luminosity function. So basically, you can use all these relationships to constrain this function. Okay. So this is what we are doing. Of course, this is a function the function you have, you know, if you don't put any constraint on the function, you have infinite number of degree of freedoms. You have to make some assumptions. Basically, what we said, okay, this conditional luminosity function, we assume it has a Schechter form, okay, like this. Except now, this the parameters now, they are all functions of mass, halo mass, because it is a conditional, right? Okay, now you can see how this you know, these parameters depend on mass. Again, that's a function, right? Then you have to parameterize that in a way that is general enough, but yet you don't want to introduce too many parameters. Otherwise, you cannot really constrain it. So what we did, we designed, you know, these functional forms, both based on, you know, observations. For example, you know, alpha, we do have some constraint for, say, for clusters and for, you know, field galaxies. And just, well, if you want the detail, you can see, you can just read the paper. Eventually, we come up with 8 free parameters. Okay, so this is one. And then we use observations and use this model, and then we use a technique, the Monte Carlo Markov chain, then try to get these free parameters. Once we get these free parameters, then we know the conditional luminosity function. So then, if that is done, then we have established a relationship between galaxies of given luminosity and the halo mass. So that's, okay, this is the result. Okay, what we did is that we use observed luminosity function. This is, again, this is a 2DF observation and the dots here, as well as the correlation function, correlation length of galaxies as a function of luminosity. Okay, this is, again, these are data points here, they are observations. And the shaded area here, they are this, you know, the range you recovered from this Monte Carlo Markov chain stuff. And one is, you know, 6 to 8, and 9 is 9 to 5, okay? And here you see, and the model actually matches the data well, but that's the input. Again, that says that the assumptions we made, at least they are consistent with observation. So this is not surprising. The surprising thing is here. Well, it's not, this is the output of the result. Now, since we have the constraint on these parameters in the conditional luminosity function, then we can just plot this in different ways. For example, we can plot the average luminosity in a halo of a given mass m. So this is what comes out.
Please write down on the board the functional form that you choose to parameterize, phi tilde. Do you have chalk?
Whoa.
What are the functions that you use for phi?
This is basically just a broken power loss.
So each of them has a broken
power. Yeah, yes, that's right. It's not a single power loss. They're broken power loss with different, you know, gamma 1, gamma 2, with this index, indices.
Could you not put the data with a single power loss?
Single power law, no. You cannot just fit the things in with a single power law.
So you've kind of iterated and done some model selection and come up with broken power laws as being.
Yeah, that's right. We have definitely just tried different things. Yeah, but this is, you're right. You said the broken power law is almost the minimum kind of thing you can do. You can introduce other things, but then you don't have a good constraint on that. But a single power law does not work.
So I understand why the luminosity in that parameterization question depends on the mass, because you can't have a luminosity that's too big and a mass that's small.
Yes, that's right.
But why do you feel the need to have the thin end slope vary with mass?
The thin end slope?
Yeah, the alpha. Why does alpha vary?
Well, that, yeah, you're right. So that first you have to get the luminosity function correct, and the second thing is you have to get this correct. If you put a lot of say, if you have an alpha, right? If the alpha is very steep, that means you have a lot, say, 4 clusters. Then that means you put a lot of faint galaxies in clusters, and that will boost the correlation function for the faint galaxies by a lot, and that's why it is a constraint. Okay. Now, so this is not a linear function, as I said. Luminosity and mass is not a linear function. And you have seen this, maybe this figure, and this is more or less the same thing, except here is plotted, you know, the mass to light ratio. But the mass here is the halo mass, and the light here is the total light in a halo versus halo mass. Okay, so now you see several interesting things. First, the mass to light has a minimum. That is about 10 to 12 solar mass. What does that mean? That means star formation, or the conversion factor from mass to stars, is the most efficient here. As you go to large halos, and actually, you know, the fraction of the mass that can be converted into stars actually goes down. It just goes in this way. And if you go to small halos, you also have a, you know, inefficient star formation, in a sense. This is very steep, people just say, you know. But, you know, this has nothing to do with the model. This only says if you believe CDM model, then you would require this in order to match the finite luminosity function, the luminosity function at the finite end. Whether this is true or not, I don't know. So you may ask, you know, whether you do have such dark galaxies there. I don't know. If you don't, eventually you say, okay, we don't find any. Then that says CDM may have some problem. It's just like, you know, when we look at sub-halos, if we don't see many, and this actually is more robust because, as I said, it does not really depend on many things like how the sub-halos can be destroyed or this kind of thing. This is a really, really robust, you know, kind of a prediction. If you don't see this kind of galaxies, very dark galaxies, then CDM model is wrong.
So, for sure,
yeah.
Yellow lines show 1 and 2 sigma
deletion. Yeah. This one?
Yeah.
Well, this is, everything has come from this, you know, Monte Carlo Markov chain. And that is, you know, you put this observation uncertainties into that, right? It's just like a chi-square. So this is the parameter you obtained that allows by, you know, this the 1 or 2 sigma.
So these are statistical errors of your particular model that was asking about.
That's right.
Other
well, you should look at, we tried many things. This kind of behavior does not change, okay? So that's a...
Right, but how wide does that street become if you consider different models, different parameterizations of your parameters?
So if you, well, as I said, you know, if you use this broken power law thing, then you don't have other degree of freedom. This is what, you know, you get, right? But then if you use just one single power law, then even you cannot really fit the things here. So then, I don't know, so that's...
Yeah, but there are other functions than single or double parallels. So you could test the systematic dependence.
Right. We haven't done a very, very, you know, extended survey here. So what we are saying, we have tried, you know, single power law, and we tried, you know, this double power law. That's it.
I mean, this is not just the generic feature, the fact that the slopes are different.
Yeah.
You would expect this whatever you do, right?
Yeah.
But when you say that if CDM doesn't predict the lines as you plot them and it's reflected out, it still depends on your parameterization.
That I don't believe, but I, you know, in order to convince you, I don't know how to convince you. You know, basically, you could do many, many strange things. Like, you know, if this is a conditional luminosity function, actually, it's not a continuous function, for example. Then, of course, you can get whatever you want, in a sense. But if you enforce some kind of, you know, just continuity, or, you know, I think double power law is quite powerful, in a sense, because actually, you know, you have this characteristic mass and also two slopes, and then, well.
If you scale this to the substructure level, I mean, do you miss an equal amount of these galaxies as you, an equal number of these galaxies as you miss mm-hmm. substructures in a galaxy? I mean,
well, that's a very good point.
I
think it's related. It's very related. Basically, because here we use, you know, we consider the mass function of halos, right? But if you look in at the simulation, the number of subhalos, well, first of all, if you don't consider, you know, the process that destroy halos, and in fact, when, you know, these halos come in fact, the mass function is more or less the same as the mass function of the general population, right? It's only when it goes in that it destroys, something like that. I think it's related, but I don't know, you know, exactly in number, I don't know.
The data on the lower right-hand panel, those data points?
Oh, no. So this is a semi-analytic model.
Okay, so you're comparing theory to theory.
Yes.
But
Yeah, but this is also. You're right. But in fact, now you do have observational data, so that's what I will come to. And you also see this shape, but you don't see this part because this is very low mass halos. Okay, and here maybe Nansen can do something. You know, this I don't know. But then, you know, since now you have this function, you can look at this function in different ways. Here is just two examples. For example, you just want to look at, you know, say, I go to the universe and then I observe galaxies. And then of each galaxy has a halo around it. So then you ask, what is the most likely kind of system you will see? And then that's the peak here. Basically, it says, if you go to the universe, most likely you will see a galaxy with, you know, 10 to the 10 solar luminosity and living in a halo of about 10 to 12. Okay, so that's something like that. And it has this very strange shape. Actually, this is very interesting. Look at here. What happens is here, you have very low luminosity galaxies and in very massive halos. That's basically because you have this faint red galaxies, which actually is quite strongly clustered, and which can also be seen here. What is shown here is that given a luminosity, if I give a galaxy luminosity, I'm asking, you know, what kind of halo this kind of galaxy is living in. And this is what shown here. If you select very faint galaxies, like 100s of L star, most of them are more or less in small halos. But then if you go to 1/10 of L star, then it is, again, it's shifted a little bit, but it has a long tail here. And some of them already, you know, just can be found in very massive halos. And if you go to L star galaxies, look at this, is a very narrow distribution, right? And their halo properties are quite uniform. But if you go to L star galaxies, the distribution is very, very broad, which says that L stars can live both in very small halos, 10 to 12, and massive halos, as massive as the clusters.
Is this dominated by spiral galaxies? Because, I mean, you don't expect low surface brightness in
the right? Well, this is not no surface bright. No luminosity, right?
No, but I mean, if you have
I mean,
this is dominated by spirals.
Yeah. This one, they are dominated by later type. Yeah, you're right. That's right.
Even a L star, right? I mean, you haven't split this in spirals versus elliptical.
We did that, but they're saying in another paper. Basically, it says, yeah, you're right. If you look at the correlation function, if you look at red galaxies, and actually it has an opt-in as you go to faint luminosity. That means you do have small faint red galaxies in massive halos, and that will translate. Even for this, you will have, you know, very broad, a little bit here, and then a lot of in the tail. Okay.
So this function on the left, that's basically the thing that you're trying to reconstruct out of the data. Right?
This one. Yeah. There's all. This is all based on the derived condition luminosity.
But the constraints that you have on this left, this theoretical beast on the left, are a few one-dimensional projections like the luminosity function and the mass function and the bias factors. It's maybe three or four one-dimensional functions, right?
Yeah.
So if you look at this as a tomography problem, it's very under-constrained. You could imagine many other functions on the left that projected the same observables, I imagine.
Well, basically, what we plot here is just this function. And then, you are right. Then everything comes down to, you know, because everything else we know is only this condition luminosity function that we parameterize by 8 parameters. And you may say, okay, we are not directly just constrained this, you know, this function itself. This is derived from here. So I don't know whether that answers your question. If this one is well constrained, then this one is also well constrained. Yeah, the equivalent. Yeah. Well, time goes very fast. Well, here maybe you know, I prepare a lot of things, but you know, I can skip off the one thing is that you ask, you know, if I change my cosmology, can everything work? And the question is not. Just give you an example. If I have a sigma 8 that's very, very high, then I predict a lot of massive clusters. Now, in order to match the observed clustering of galaxies, you know, I can only put a small number of galaxies in these massive halos because, you know, the observed number is is fixed, and they have to be shared by a large number of clusters. What happens is that I will have a very, very large mass-to-light ratio for clusters. Now, we know if you believe that mass-to-light ratio for clusters is something around 300 or 500, then actually you cannot really get a consistent result for all different kind of cosmology. Well, of course, you have other constraints like the correlation, like the luminosity function, and actually this is exactly what we did there. We put this together, and we see, we just look at the CDM models, but then now we treat sigma 8 and omega meta as a free parameter, as free parameters. And this is what you get. This is the best value we get. This, look, this is a 2003. Look at this value. Sigma 8, that time we got is 0.75. It's exactly there because we run up. It's not. And omega meta is a 0.25. We got very worried about that because that time it is the concordance model. It should be here. This is a 0.9, and this one should be 0.3. We cannot get consistent result there. But then, you know, when WMAP 3, the 3 year, they published their new result. I see, okay. We are forced to this now. The truth is not truth, right? so this is a...
Do you have any idea if it's sensitive to double Paolo assumption?
You mean the rolling kind of thing? Yeah, that's also, but then here we don't include that. That if you include that, then, you know, that may also change things, because if you have N, that's not exactly one. That's what you're asking, right?
No, double Paolo. In
the conditional luminosity? No.
It's not sensitive to...
It's not, well, I don't think it's, Well, as I said, we haven't tried too many things by introducing, say, even more parameters, right? Well, here I just want to say one thing. Now, this conditional luminosity function that makes the connections between halos and the galaxies, a very, very useful thing for this is to construct mocks. Because this is model independent. You know that it will reproduce your luminosity function. You know it will reproduce your clustering. And you know it will produce maybe mass-to-light ratio. Now, if you have simulations, you can identify halos, then you can use this conditional luminosity function to populate these halos with galaxies of different luminosity. That's the ideal thing to do, mock, right? A lot of things. This is what I did, what we did, okay? And but the detail, you know, you need high resolution simulations, you need blah, blah, blah. But okay, once you have this, maybe I should, you know, just want to make the point why we need a low sigma 8. That's another thing we did. Now you have a mock catalog. And you also have, mock catalog for 2DF or SDSS, right? Now you can do one thing. You look at the clustering properties of galaxies. And you can, in fact, measure the clustering of galaxies in redshift space. That is, you count pairs in redshift space. Redshift space now is described by the separation, perpendicular to your line of sight. That's not affected by peculiar velocity. And also the separation along line of sight, that would be affected by peculiar velocity. Peculiar velocity will be affected by mass distribution. So in fact, exactly, you will see that it will also give you constraint on mass as well as on sigma 8, because if you have a high sigma 8, then you have perturbation amplitude that's higher. Okay, this is what we did. And I don't need to explain here. And on different scales, you would expect this redshift distortion will have different signatures. On large scale, it is a squashing effect because the volume here is bigger than here in the redshift space. And while if you have a virialize the system, the volume here actually is smaller than here. So that means if you look at things in redshift space on large scale, the clustering will be enhanced because the density contrast becomes larger in redshift space here, but it will be reduced, suppressed on small scale because now the density now is spread in this volume instead of this volume, right? But that's exactly what you see. So this is real data. This is a 2DF. This is published by Peacock. And what plotted here is the correlation amplitude as a function, of pi and just in the perpendicular direction. And you see on small scale, this is elongation, and on large scale, this is a squashing. And these observations now, they are, you know, from SDSS, from 2DF, you can measure these things quite well. You know, you can measure the redshift space correlation function, which is shown here, and then the real space correlation function is shown here, exactly as you see on small scale, because this is elongation effect. The redshift space correlation function is lower than this, right? And then you can also just try to model what kind of velocity you need to reproduce this kind of pattern. And that's basically shown here. You have, the pairwise per clear velocity, you know, how fast a pair of galaxies they are moving relative to each other. And this is the large scale squashing effect. Okay, this is not important. This is observation. Now, yeah, sorry for that. Now, we have a good mock catalog that reproduce the luminosity function as well as the correlation function on large scale. And now we can construct a mock catalog using this, but using a cosmology, like a concordance cosmology. What is it shown here? You see, on large scale, by definition, the mock matches observation very well, because that, again, is put in by hand, right? Because I use the correlation lens as my input. So this is, well. But if you look at this on small scale, it does not work well. You over-predict the clustering power on small scale. And this can also be seen in the redshift space correlation function. Okay. Another thing, just look at this. The model fails badly here. Look at it here. This is the how fast a pair of galaxies, they're moving, approaching, or going apart from each other. This is what you observed. And this is what you predict. This is a very large difference here. That already says probably concordance model, old concordance model, does not work. And this, again, this is a paper we published in 2004.
So this comes out from an analytical estimate, or is this actually also, is that the same when you actually look at the?
No, this is by compare observations with mock. The mock is constructed in such a way that the luminosity function and the correlation function on large scale are reproduced. So, yeah. Then you look at the other things and to see if you can get a consistent result. You can. This is a consistent result. Look at this is exactly the same thing, except now we consider a different kind of model. One model is that I change sigma h from 0.9 to 0.75. Look at here. Look at here, look at here. They all match. But that's not the only model that works. As I said, you can also make the model work by increase your mass to light ratio of clusters. If you believe the mass to light ratio is as high as 1,000, then you can also make things work. Again, the reason being, there is a correlation between sigma 8 and mass to light ratio, just as I said before. Okay, so well, you can make a choice. Either you believe this or you believe this. Okay, so this. So I don't have so much time, about the other part. Now you have this very large surveys like SDSS or 2DF. Now you can, and also you have quite a good theory now. Actually, you can take advantage of this knowledge to find group finders, to develop group finders such that your group finder can put galaxies according to their common halos. That's the most physical way to do it. If some people say, okay, I can select clusters or groups, and if that has nothing to do with the halos, then you are very detached from theory, in a sense. And since now we have this kind of, this knowledge about CDM halo, then we can make use of that. So what can you make use of here? If you have a CDM halo, if I know the mass somehow, then I know how big the halo is. And I also know the velocity dispersion. But that's exactly what you need to search memberships. If I have a tentative mass of a group, then I can go to the observation again, and then I search according to the velocity dispersion as well as the size. Now I will get more galaxies in, then I update the mass, and then I do it again. So then eventually it will converge. And this is exactly what we did here. Okay. So, and this works. And here's shown here, as I said, you have a very well-defined mock catalog. Now you can test your group finder using these mocks. And what is shown here is the total luminosity of the halo or of the group you input. That's from the mock itself. And this is what you recovered after using this group finder. So this is a quite good, you know, this is for galaxies, you know, all galaxies, this is for relatively bright galaxies, this is very bright galaxies, they all work, okay? And this group finder is better than the traditional FOF, this is shown here. What is shown, forget about other things, just look at this. Here again, these circles here, they show what you should get based on mock, because for the mock catalog, you know everything. And this is what you get using our group finder. So it matches quite well. It goes down. Why? That's because as you go to high redshift, you have only a small number of galaxies to do things, and then you know completeness goes down. But if you look at the traditional friend kind of method, it overpredicts the number of systems at high redshift. Why? It's also easy to understand. Because the group of friend of friend kind of thing, they use a mean separation determined by the mean separation of galaxies at that redshift. Basically, as you move to high redshift, you use a very large link length, and which can link many, many interlopers. So this is what is happening. Okay. You have a question? No. Now, with this, then you can do many things. And this is very impressive, I would say. This is a correlation as a function of the mean separation of the systems. Like these are groups, these are observations. And here you say, okay, am I right that to associate these groups with halos? In terms of clustering, yes, because this is what you get by making such association. And then the correlation length increase with richness, and in such a way that is exactly what you would expect about the mass dependence of of halos. It's the same thing here. Well, now it may be more interesting to you, people doing Nansen. So what in here is something like this. You have a well-defined group catalog. Then you can look at how satellite galaxies, meaning here, the non-central galaxies, are distributed around the central galaxy. And this, the solid line here is an observation. Okay, so you have this decreased kind of, shape, N of W, you can fit it. But if you look in the detail, if you fit this by N of W, you'd get a concentration. Here, there's only 3, here is 2.9, and here is 2.4. Why for this kind of halos, the concentration you would expect is 10 here, and here is 8.6, and here is 7. So what it says, the distribution of galaxies in halos, they are much less concentrated than the mass itself, if you believe CDM.
I lost it.
What's WP? WP, this is just a projected.
Projected what?
Projected correlation function. But it is, you can just look at in such a way, this is a normalized surface density.
So this number density.
Surface number density, yeah. But it's subtracted background, it's normalized. Yeah.
So is this
saying
that the centers are dominated by single matter?
That could be, yeah. Now, is another thing that might be interesting to you, that's alignment. I think, Dennis mentioned about that. But here, what we did is that now we have, we select these halos, right? And then we know this central galaxies and the distribution of the satellite galaxies. The question we'll ask, whether the orientation of the central galaxy is somehow correlated with the distribution of the satellite galaxies. So if the distribution of the satellite galaxies trace that of dark matter halo, then you will say, okay, whether the orientation is correlated with that of dark matter halo. So we did a lot of things, and here the dots here, they are the observation. And just compare this one to this one. Here, this one to this one, sorry. The difference here is that here, you look at only red centrals. And here you see a very significant signal, because it's different from one. If you have a random orientation, it should be one. Why for blue centrals, you see almost...
The P is defined as?
P, that's the probability of finding, you know, a situation where, you know, the angle between the major axis of the central galaxies and the major axis of the satellite galaxy distribution. Okay, that's the probability. So the fact that you find many, many such angles, that means that they are correlated because the angle is more or less zero. Right? Okay, and here you don't see it. Now there's a number of lines here. These are what you would expect. You say, okay, if I assume the orientation of the central galaxies is exactly the same as that of dark matter halos, this is what you would expect. This is much, much stronger. Basically, the distribution of the satellite galaxies, or well, in a sense, the orientation of the central galaxies should not be exactly the same as the major axis of the dark matter halo. And here you see this dotted point. That's, you know, you just do something. You introduce some kind of misalignment angle. And here this for this red one, you need a misalignment angle of something like a 30 degree. It's a Gaussian with zero mean, but a 30 degree in dispersion. Okay. And for blue galaxies, you need a misalignment angle of something like a 50 or 60. That basically says there's no correlation here.
When you make one of these Mach catalogs, you have a halo.
Yeah.
You have to put the galaxies in the halo.
Yeah.
And you have to put them at positions.
Yeah.
How do you decide at which position?
Good point. We tried a lot of things. One thing is that you make an assumption that the satellite galaxies, they have a distribution like NFW, but with a different kind of halo concentration. And for the centrals, then again, you have some options whether you put it...
Do you just say that the brightest galaxy is the central galaxy?
And we also just include some offset.
Okay. So after you assign luminosities to the cluster,
yeah,
you have a set of luminosities for galaxies,
yeah,
then you assign positions.
Right.
The first thing you do is you take the brightest galaxy and put it close to the center.
Correct. That's what we did. That we always call the brightest galaxy as the central galaxy. Okay. Can I move on? Okay. So now here, there's another set of line. Here you make an assumption. Well, this is something quite interesting. Let's make another assumption. There is the orientation of your central galaxy is determined by the spin of the halo. And here, for this blue galaxy, now it works. This is actually disappointing, because originally said, maybe nothing works, so that's fine. But then it really works. It says, okay, but it makes sense. This assumption actually makes sense for this kind of galaxies, because if this is a spiral galaxy or something like that, they're blue. And of course, their orientation is determined by spin axis instead of, you know, the shape of the halo itself. Okay, so this is a... Okay.
But you're also saying then that it works better for the red galaxies as well, right?
But that, you know, it also works better. I think that's just a fluke. Because there, you know, you cannot really, why is it spin, you know? I don't know. So this is what, you know, you get from here. You know, what it tells us, I don't know. Okay. Now, this is more or less a summary of, another thing is that now you have groups. You can look at this halo occupation statistics directly from this observation. What is shown here, this is the central galaxy luminosity versus the mass of the halo the galaxies are in. And here the red line is what you get from this conditioned luminosity function. There you can go down to very low mass. This is what you see. This is a, you know, very large mass to odor ratio here. The dots here, this is data points, that's actually based on the group catalogs we have, we obtain. And we cannot go down here. That's because for these very low mass halos, you don't have many members. But by and large, over this range, they match very well.
It's not a fit.
No, it's not a fit. This is these are two things that are not completely independent. One, this one is obtained directly from the group catalog, and this one is what you obtained from this conditioned luminosity function kind of technique. More interestingly, look at this. For this very bright end, or the massive end, this, you know, luminosity goes with mass very, very slowly. In the middle range is something like a two-thirds. And this is, you know, if you, some of you may remember, this is exactly what you get from Nansen over this, you know, isolated systems. And this range is not a constraint. I don't know what will happen. Okay. So it is in this range that, you know, maybe Nansen can play a very important role. Even, as I said, in this range, the fact that we get Nansen result and this result consistent with each other, that's really very, very encouraging.
So are these data points come from the 2DF catalog?
Yeah.
And they're determining the masses of groups.
Yes.
That are less massive than 10 to the 13th solar masses. How?
You mean how we determine the mass?
Yes. Oh.
So that's actually, in a sense, a model-dependent way, is that we rank these groups according to their luminosity or total stellar mass. Then we go to the halo mass function, so then we match. This is really just according to the ranking. Okay. So actually, this is a very good point. So we do have a zero point here that may be determined by Nansen. So whether, you know, the mass assignment is correct or not, we don't know because you don't have a way. Unless you have a mesh.
But yeah. Having done that, how independent, I mean, this is not a fit, you say, but mm-hmm. how independent then is the red line from the data?
Well,
this doesn't, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is, aren't you using the model in effect to construct the data and then you're comparing the model again?
No, well, that's.
Are they independent?
No, this, I think it's in, it's, you can say they are correlated in such sense because both make an assumption that you have a CDM, you know, kind of, you know, model. And here we only use the ranking, right? Use the mass, even not, you know, but here there's a lot of things. Well, I think they're connected, but I don't know how degenerate they are. So that's what I can think at the moment. So Nansen, this, as I said, this is what you get, you know, you based on the galaxy Nansen, this, you know, and here is, well, we try to model people observed in SDSS, but what we did is that, you know, observations give you something like a aperture mass at 260, this is a very strange one, and then what we did is that we convert this into halo mass, and so then this is the data. The Nansen data, and if you fit through this one, you get this. Halo mass versus luminosity, and it's 1.5. 1.5 is exactly the slope, right? There we got 2 over 3, because that's the inverse relation. So this is very encouraging, right? And even the amplitude here, eventually, you should use the amplitude obtained by Nansen to exactly test what Anne just said, right? I don't know exactly the mass assignment is correct or not. But this may give a constraint on that, the amplitude. Well, I don't know, so maybe I should stop. this is another thing we did recently, is that if we have subhalos, do we have a way to detect this using, you know, gravitational Nansen? Here again, this is a serious kind of, it's not an observational kind of a plot. So what we did here is, again, we're using Mach catalogs. But now we ask the question, suppose we have a group finder, and this group finder is not perfect, that we are bringing interlopers and sometimes contaminations. Will these kind of contaminations screw up everything when you try to, you know, recover the mass of the satellite galaxies? So this is a in fact, a test of that. What is shown here is that we use this, you know, we assign in this mock catalog, assign each satellite galaxy with a halo mass, with a halo, according to its luminosity. How? There's a detailed thing is that according to the simulated properties of subhalos, and you know that, you know, how their final mass is related to their initial mass, and then the initial mass, what we did is should relate to luminosity. You can argue whether it's true or not, but that's not the purpose here. The purpose here is that if you do that, and if you look at the Nansen signal you expect, but now you not average this signal over all different kind of galaxies. Instead, you look at the galaxies with in a given luminosity bin, and also for galaxies that are at located at different locations in a host halo. So this is what you get. So if you look at the halos of this mass and use this this kind of assignment, then you consider halos around the satellite galaxies that is located something like here, this is 100 kiloparsec from the center, and here this is another is 200. So you see this kind of a curve. And this curve here, in the outer part, that's dominated by the gravitational potential well of the big halo itself. And you see this small, these spikes here, that's exactly what you assign, the signal of the satellite, or of the subhalos you assigned to these satellite galaxies. Can we do make progress on this? And this is what you, what this is what?
I didn't follow what you've done.
Mm-hmm.
You had a conditional distribution of luminosity for a halo of a given mass.
Yeah.
Given that, you assign a number of galaxies,
yeah,
each of which has a luminosity.
Yeah.
In order to look at the lensing effects,
yeah,
associated with the structure within the halo,
mm-hmm,
you have to go back and start assigning masses,
yeah,
to those luminosities.
Yes.
So how do you assign masses to, well, those luminosities?
That's what I said. It's for these satellite galaxies,
for based a given luminosity.
For a given luminosity.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then I go to say the subhalo mass function,
mm-hmm,
and then I I convert that mass function into the mass function before they merge into the halo. Then I use that mass function. Well, I hope.
You're using information that you've not told us about.
Yeah,
this
okay.
It does not come from the 2DF catalog. It
no.
It does not come from your model. It comes from somewhere. Your information about the subhalo mass.
Yeah, that's what I said. That's these the properties of the subhalos that come from simulations.
Who's?
Kravtsov or, you know, Gao or this, you know, we use those information, the mass function and how they are stripped and the typical truncation radius. As I said, this is, you know, the details, well, I can't explain, but need time, but we try to incorporate all this information as in detail as possible. So that's what we did, okay. And so basically this is the shaded area, this is what you input, the mass, and this is versus, you know, versus the halocentric distance. And the data here is, not the data, there's the points here, this is what you recovered running through this group finder and all this thing. Well, basically it says if your observers can observe things to a very, very high accuracy, basically you can recover the mass of subhalos in this way, because you do have a good group finder which can group things together. By the way, these points, and here you don't see them because it's below that, this is the contamination. Because you do have because you put galaxies maybe, you know, in the wrong place or something like that. This is the contamination level given by this group finder. Basically, it's much lower than the signal you try to detect. I think I should stop here, and the rest of it is more, maybe interesting to people who are doing galaxy formation. But so these are the conclusions. Okay, thanks.
Questions? More questions?
You're all convinced?
So maybe if I summarize this, just means so in principle with this patient function, you can describe all the uncertainties we know in going from basically the dominant distribution to the lower sparse distribution. So you say that's the only kind of that encapsulates all our ignorance into a very simple function.
That's right.
And our goal is now to understand physics to explain that function.
You're right. That's right. And actually, that's the later part. You know, in fact, the current galaxy formation model cannot really match what you obtained there. That's very interesting. People are talking about supernova feedback, and in fact, depending on how you implement it, you may screw things up. You may not match you know, what you obtained from the data. So that's,
it looked like they were getting sort of close when you compared the semi-analytic model.
Oh, if you want to see that, that's the one. Here, this is you use the SDSS groups and you look at the blue fraction versus you know the low velocity, and here and for galaxies in different halos, and well halos, yeah, here is shown here. This is, and this is what you see from the observation, and it goes down as you expected. You know the blue fraction goes down as you go to high mass systems and. This is what you get using this millennium simulation. They are not the same. They are not close. But they are very close if you don't look at these quantities in this way. You don't divide systems according to their mass. You just look at everything together. They match very well. This is the luminosity distribution, and here this is the bimodal, you know, the color thing, you know, and the red sequence. Well, you know, you have red sequence, blue sequence, or something like this. This is SDSS. This is a millennial survey. They match very well.
Sorry, I didn't get that. What was the difference now to what you showed before? I mean, you said.
This is, you look at the whole galaxy population without dividing them into halos, into systems. So you see my point? Okay.
Not dividing into halos.
Well, So what do you see here? So this is the blue fraction versus galaxy luminosity for galaxies in different groups, and these different groups, look at these different lines here.
Oh, okay.
These are different groups, they're represented by the group mass. Mm-hmm. And in that, you know, in the previous one, they don't consider that. They lump everything together. So this is a difference.
So in this group finder,
yeah.
You said you increase the spatial and the redshift direction to include more, and then you iterate on this.
Yeah.
Do you also take into account shape there?
No, at the moment, no.
Okay, how important would that be?
We haven't checked that, that's a good point. But, yeah. Yeah.
Have you looked at the conditional luminosity function as a function of wavelength and redshift?
Redshift, no. Actually, this is a limitation of this kind of thing. You don't have but for different galaxies like blue and red, we did that. Well, they compare that certainly as you expected, then.
Well, blue shows your current star formation.
Oh, yeah.
Red shows your integrated star formation.
So you're using the halo itself. That's we have a paper that exactly shows. Well, something is shown here, right? That's the blue fraction goes down and the red fraction goes up. But if you're asking, you know, the condition luminosity function, and we also fitted the condition luminosity functions separately for blue and the red. So that's and then it all makes sense that you know you put more red galaxies in big halos, and that's because the clustering is stronger or this kind of thing. Yeah.
We were able to do the evolution by combining with the deep survey.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good point. And people are doing this. And we have been talking about this for a long time. basically what you can do is that now you have a very good way at redshift zero, a good catalog at redshift zero. Basically, can I just trace it back to redshift one according to the star formation history or whatever, and then I can build up you know, halo occupation kind of statistics at that time to match the observations there. That will give you some constraint, you know, about your evolution model. So this is, in principle, it can be done, but yeah.
Should probably stop here for now. So yeah. Thank you.